Hey guys, I'm Paul Bates and this is the Fermentation Podcast. Join me on this journey to put fermentation into practice, create culture, and revive this lost art that connects all of us to our cultures of the past. Today is Wednesday, October 1st, 2014, and we're getting into fall. This is episode number 8. I think I have a great show for you today. Today with me, I have a girl named Ariana Mullins, and she runs a blog called AndHereWeAre.net. And we talk about all kinds of things relating to fermentation, making soda, cider, wine, foraging for wild edibles, living in England, what it's like to be an expatriate living abroad, just speaking about different food philosophies in general, and how you can get started into fermentation, and it's not as hard as you think it is. If you visit her website or her Pinterest page, you'll probably leave there either feeling hungry or just wanting to learn how to do some of the things that she has on there. She has so many recipes, so many pictures, and she even creates YouTube videos showing you how to do some of these amazing things. I'm really excited about this interview, and I hope you guys like it too. But first, all the topics and links for today's show will be in the show notes at fermentationpodcast.com. And if you'd like to get a hold of me, email me at paul@fermentationpodcast.com or go to the website and click on the contact button on the top. You can also connect with me on Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube, and Twitter. Just go to fermentationpodcast.com. You should see the links in the sidebar. Also, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, just head out to the website and click on the guest button on top. There's a guest submission form that I have there so you can fill out. Today we have on the show Ariana Mullins from the blog And Here We Are, and also author of the cookbook And Here We Are at the Table. She's an American writer, cook, explorer, photographer, and shares her family's stories of challenge and adventure as expatriates in Europe, as well as inspiration for living a simple and meaningful life. She has a passion for restoring lost kitchen arts and loves to share her experiences in foraging, butchery, home brewing, and anything new that she can get her hands on in her English kitchen. Ariana, welcome to the Fermentation Podcast.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh yeah, no problem. You know, actually, I found your blog from Pinterest, and I'll go over that later, you know, with your blackberry soda that I had found. But can you give the audience a brief introduction of yourself and maybe just a little bit of your story?
Sure. I'm kind of a dabbler in lots of things. I have a real interest in just kind of learning traditional kitchen skills that are kind of lost today. I feel like, you know, so much of that traditional knowledge that we used to have is slowly going away. And it's my mission to learn as much as I can from whoever's around me and to kind of impart that to anyone who is willing to listen and wants to learn. So that has given me a whole bunch of really interesting experiences. And right now we've been living in England for about 3 years. And it's been really fun to kind of explore some of the traditions here and just kind of check out what's going on around us and living a pretty slow life. So that's kind of my story.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, I've never been over to England, but someday I would love to go. Mm-hmm. And when you mentioned, you know, restoring lost kitchen arts or restoring lost arts, I feel the same way with fermentation. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the whole reason I started the Fermentation Podcast, just it felt like nobody was really doing this kind of thing anymore.
Yeah.
So I saw that you grew up in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And I guess you said you had 7 siblings.
Well, there's 7 of us all together. Yeah.
So okay, 7 all together. That must have been quite an experience. Mm-hmm. Over there, I mean, were there a lot of fermentation? Or was there a lot of fermentation or ferments, you know, local markets? Or did you guys eat anything fermented in your home?
We did. I don't think that we were really paying attention to fermentation at all at that stage. But just eating some traditional foods, pretty much in any country, you will end up eating some fermented products, which is really wonderful. So the first one that came to my mind is probably not going to sound super appetizing to most of your listeners. It's a traditional fermented fish dish called ginamus. And I remember my mom explaining it to me, like sounding super horrified. She said, it's this stuff that they make by putting a layer of tiny fish in a bucket. And then they put a layer of salt and they do another layer of tiny fish and they go on and on until it fills the bucket. And then they just stick it out on their back porch for a month. And then it's just this soup and you eat it.
Wow.
And it's not really a soup. It's a condiment. And actually, I was the only one in the family who genuinely enjoyed it. It's super fishy. And what we use it for is to, like a sauce, but mainly as a dip. Like, we take really starchy bananas and boil them. And then it was beach food. Like, you take your boiled bananas and you'd take a jar of Ghina mousse and you would dip your bananas in it while you ate them. So, that was probably the main one. But then, you know, like vinegar, the vinegar there was made out of fermented coconut sap. And they also had an alcoholic beverage, which we never tried, called tuba. That was coconut sap wine.
I've actually seen that. Watching some videos maybe about a month ago thinking like, oh, I wish I had coconut palms here. I would definitely try that.
Yeah.
That looked really good. I guess it ferments very, very quickly. Like within a day, it becomes very alcoholic.
Yeah. You know, I've made some ferments myself that I was like, oh, that totally smells like tuba. And I never actually tasted it because I was, you know, grew up in a missionary family and alcohol was not part of the equation. Plus, I was a child, totally inappropriate. But the smell was really strong. And I really remember the smell of what it smelled like. So now and then I'll have a ferment that I'm like, oh, my gosh, I wonder if that's what tuba tastes like. So, yeah.
And the Ghina mousse, I've mm-hmm. never heard of that either. I've gone through The Art of Fermentation, you know, with Sandra Katz.
Yeah.
And toward the end, he talks about fermenting fish and meats. And
yeah,
it sounded very interesting. I guess you said it's more of like a garnish.
Yeah. And they have another one that's really popular. You can buy it in jars that is made with shrimp called bago'ong. And I never developed a taste for that, but that's also really popular. And apparently, too, they have some local sausage that, of course, you use lacto fermentation for. And we had the sausages, but we never thought fermented. Most people don't when they think about sausage. And then they also had some rice desserts, which we had a lot of. And it never occurred to me that they could be fermented. But I did do a little search on the fermented foods, and I've eaten a lot of them, it turns out. That have fermentation as part of it. I'm wondering if it's kind of like that sort of sourdough kind of process, but just used with rice and rice flour.
Yeah, I've seen that. I know what in Indian cooking, when they make those flat dosas, yeah. A lot of times those are fermented,
mm-hmm.
fermented rice and dal lentils together.
Yeah, and they have that sourdough flavor. It's really good. Yeah.
So it looks like, at least from your website and from the Pinterest, you know, the Pinterest page that mm-hmm. I've seen, it looks like you actually like to ferment a lot of different beverages, you know, some alcoholic, some not so much.
Yeah.
I know you have a daughter. Does she like some of these things?
She does. Ironically, and somewhat sadly, she is not a big fan of fizz. So I do make sodas so that she has something to drink, but a lot of times we water them down with water because she doesn't like really fizzy drinks, but she loves to have the flavors, you know, that little bit of tartness. And I try to not let it get too sour. I love really sour fermented products, but it's kind of fun. Like almost any time I'm making like a cider or, a really fruity kind of cidery beverage. With the wine, it's a little different because of the process is different, but I can save some for her and give it to her early on as something that is great for kids. And then as it continues to ferment, then it becomes more of an adult drink. But yeah, we've been fermenting like crazy over here, a whole bunch of drinks because it's the season, you know, lots of fruit and stuff available. And it's always great if we can supply all of our own grown-up beverages for the year or at least for a few months.
Yeah, and I was starting to get into fall or winter. And I'm sure over in England, it gets a lot colder than it does here in Florida.
Yep.
But I know, you know, you start off preserving the harvest with fermentation. Mm-hmm. And I'm on your page right now about the soda, you mm-hmm. know, with your daughter drinking the blackberry soda. Mm-hmm. That was actually the first recipe I came across of yours.
Cool.
And I can tell you right now, I have a 1 gallon jar, about 3/4 full with that blackberry soda.
Oh, great.
So I've tasted it the past few days, uh-huh. and today's about the third day. It's been fermenting, you know, bubbling pretty vigorously.
Uh-huh.
So I'll be bottling it pretty soon. But yeah, it's been a pretty great recipe. And some of the pictures you take, I swear, are just gorgeous.
Well, thank you.
So on the blackberry soda, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess maybe just run through how you would make a soda like that. And I also noticed you either use honey or sucanat, which is more of like a natural sugar. I had used regular sugar, which, you know, I guess ferments a little quicker, but do you notice any difference fermenting with honey? You know, does it take longer?
I don't think it takes, if it takes longer, it doesn't take too much longer. The one thing I would say is that if, like, kind of the heavier and darker you go, for example, using like really brown sugar or molasses sugar, that'll really slow you down. I don't know what the mechanism exactly is, but those are just a lot slower. But honey doesn't seem to be a problem. And I get a lot of questions about the honey thing because people have heard maybe from making kombucha that you can't do it with honey. And so they assume that you can't do it with most other products, but that's not true at all. I mean, in fact, mead is it's like a cider made with only honey. So it ferments really well.
Oh yeah, I love mead. If I could have my own beehives and make honey, I'd be making mead all the time.
Yeah.
I guess let's see, a bottle of mead might take 6 to 9 months or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, on the blackberry soda, just maybe run through how you would make something like that. And, you know, do you use fresh blackberries, frozen?
Okay, sure. Well, you can use fresh or frozen blackberries. You can, I mean, it's actually a great thing to do mid-year. And I think that batch that you saw that I wrote a post about was from frozen because I was sort of cleaning out my freezer from the previous summer. And all you need to do is defrost them and then cover them with water in a pot and boil them. So with a berry like blackberries that has so many seeds, you're going to want to kind of do the boil method to extract the flavor because you can't just put the whole berries in. So you would just kind of boil it to get all the flavor out into the water. And then you can strain the berries out into a vessel and dissolve some sugar in there. Add a culture of your choice, and it can be some leftover juice from your sauerkraut. Question I get is, oh no, is it going to taste like sauerkraut? No, it won't, because it's just like a tablespoon or so mixed into a really sweet drink. So that's not a big deal. You can also use yogurt whey or kefir whey or kefir whey, however you want to pronounce it. So there's a lot of choices that you can make this with. It's really forgiving. It's really fun. I think people can get a little bit nervous when they're starting a new fermentation project. But I think that sodas are a great way to start because they're so quick, they're really gratifying, and it's really hard to mess them up. So after you would add your starter, you just put it in a vessel of some kind. I like to use demijohns because I have an airlock to fit them, but a lot of people make them in mason jars and just are really conscientious about burping the jars, which is super important because they get really fizzy really fast and you don't want to burst your jar. So then after that, you know, just kind of dipping in and tasting as you go. And as far as bottling goes, you want to bottle it just when it's still slightly sweeter than you want, because the bacteria will continue to kind of eat up that sugar and create CO2. So when it's a little bit sweeter than you want, bottle it up and seal the bottles. And then I would say keep them in the fridge. Because with this kind of fermentation, it's not always super predictable. And we've left a few out that were just left out longer than we should have. And more sugar was metabolized than we wanted. And so when we opened them, and it was just like the geyser effect. So you can lose a lot of soda if you wait too long or you don't store them someplace cold. And that's pretty much it. It's really simple.
Yeah, I know what you mean about the pressurization.
Yeah.
I've had a ginger ale in the fridge for maybe about a year, which is probably a little too long. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you go to open it and it takes maybe 10 minutes to really just off gas it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, you just lose half of it.
Yeah.
And I saw, you know, you said you use sauerkraut or whey from strained yogurt. Mm-hmm. I actually tried ginger bug.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the starter from ginger. I'll have to try the sauerkraut juice, see how that tastes.
Yeah, the ginger bug one is fantastic too. But I often don't keep a culture necessarily around if I don't remember. So with the ginger bug, you have to kind of feed it, and it's great. But if you happen to let your ginger bug die or you don't have one, then it's so easy to just get a little bit of whey or the juice from some sauerkraut.
Do you ever take these sodas and ferment them all the way out, you know, to to eat up all of the sugar? I know it increases the alcohol in there.
Yeah, we've had some that we, you know, we're like, oh, we have some more of this soda left in the fridge, and we open it and we're like, oh, that's like a grown-up drink now. So yeah, it does eventually turn to alcohol. We've never let them turn to vinegar or anything like that. But yeah, I mean, pretty much all of these drinks, you know, the end is always alcohol. And maybe beyond that, if you go beyond that, then it is vinegar. So yeah.
It also looks like you said you're excited about making wines.
Yes.
Can you talk maybe a little bit about that and what the difference would be between, you know, making a lacto-fermented soda and a wine?
Sure. Winemaking is something that I just started doing in the last couple of years. My first wine was an elderberry wine. I heard elderberry wine was really good. I'd never tried it before. But we have so many elderberries in the area, and I had never even used them before this, because I just wasn't used to being able to use them. They weren't in the areas that I was before. So I decided to try to make one. And my approach to a lot of things is really laid back. I love to wing it and kind of learn as I go. And I'm not really afraid of making mistakes. So I think that attitude is really helpful when it comes to fermentation, because sometimes you need to just try, you need to get started. And if something doesn't go right, you know, to look at it and say, oh, how fascinating. I wonder what that means. And then you get to learn more about it in the process by making mistakes. So that's kind of how I thought that my first winemaking experience would be, that it probably wouldn't be great, but that I would learn something from it. Well, it actually turned out to be really amazing. I made this elderberry wine, and I was totally winging it and did a few things that I thought would probably wreck it. And it didn't ruin it. And I heard that a year is about when you want to start drinking it, it gets really good. And we opened ours a year later, and we were really blown away by how good this elderberry wine was. And I like wine, so it's not like, you know, I have really low standards for how a wine should taste. I'm actually kind of picky, and both my husband and I were really impressed. So that got me really excited. And since then, I have made so many different kinds of wines, and they are all fruit wines, they're fruit and flower wines, and none of them are from grapes. So you can make wine out of just about anything, and it makes it just really fun. So right now I have in my sort of brewery, which is just where I line up all my demijohns in my dining room, we have plum wine, we have a big batch of elderberry wine, I have apple cider, and then I also have a green gauge wine going on, which is like a really tart little green plum, and a slow wine, which is also, slows are also related to plums, and they're really awful to eat raw, but they make really good beverages. So the basic method for making a fruit wine is to mash your fruit and then pour boiling water over them, and then let them sit for a few days in they call it a primary fermenter, which is just basically like a barrel. We have like a big plastic bucket that has a lid. And then after a few days, you add sugar, usually some lemon juice, or if you want to be a little more technical, tartaric acid, and you add your yeast. You let it sit for a few more days, and then you put it into demijohns after you strain out all the fruit pulp. And then from there, it's just a matter of aging and racking. And when fermentation stops, then you can bottle it. And different wines require different amounts of time before drinking them. So it just kind of varies. But it's really an easy process. And I really hope some of your listeners will kind of explore and give it a try, because it's so much fun to do. It's totally good, cheap fun. And it's how people used to make wine, you know. It wasn't from wineries. It was from your, you know, the fruit that you gathered, you know, mashed in your barrel, stored in your cellar. You know, this is really kind of authentic drinking here. And I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, I'm sure you can get so many more flavors than what you could possibly mm-hmm. buy It's the feeling of actually making
totally.
It yourself.
And if you get to serve it to someone who comes over to your house, that's such a beautiful feeling too.
On the making wines and some of the other things that you do you mostly use like a champagne yeast, or do you ever try wild fermentation with just yeasts that are naturally in
yes,
the air?
Yes, both. So right now we just finished a huge batch of cider. And these are from foraged apples that we found in our neighborhood. So we have 3 gallons going right now. And the way I like to make cider is through wild fermentation. I don't buy any commercial yeasts. We happen to live in an area that's kind of famous for cider. So the natural yeast in the air is a really good one. Not everybody likes the flavor of the wild yeast in their area. So that's something to consider. But where we live, we have a great wild yeast. So you can do the wild thing. And I've done wild yeast also with plums, and it ends up being more like a cider because, again, the yeast that's in the air around here is that sort of cidery yeast. And so I did a wild plum cider, I'm going to call it, even though it doesn't have apple juice in it, for lack of a better word, because it ended up tasting a lot like cider, and that was really good. Another one is we would use like a champagne yeast or a cider yeast with a wine that we made with flowers, like elderflower champagne, or I've made a rose wine, like a sparkling rose wine. And then with the fruit ones, I usually buy a commercial yeast. I've used a cider yeast with a plum wine before, and that was great because it just was so much more fast-acting than the wine yeast. So that was good. And with the elderberry wine, I use a red wine yeast. So it just kind of varies depending on what you're fermenting. And again, it's kind of one of those things that you get to experiment with and see what you like best. I found that I like cider yeast more than I like champagne yeast for certain things. So we've used it all.
Yeah, I bet. I can only imagine, you know, the different flavors that come from different mm-hmm. bacteria and different
yeah.
yeasts. Yeah, that's pretty cool that you make your own cider too. I've used maybe a handful of apples, you know, juiced them and then just kind of stirred them up. And after about a week, I had a little bit of a cider. But what would be the difference between just like a regular cider? And I saw you had a recipe or how to make a hard cider. How would you go about making a hard cider? Or is it just fermented longer and so the alcohol content
is
higher?
Yeah, and when I say cider, I know in the U.S. the cider is just like apple juice. And I always forget that. So when I say cider, I really do mean a hard cider. Our process for making hard cider is actually really simple. And it just amounts to juicing your apples and crab apples. And we've used some pears as well. And then putting it in a demijohn and letting it go. And then you rack it to separate the yeast and the sediment. And you let it go a little bit longer. And then you bottle it up. And there's so many different ways you can do it. You can use wine yeast, you can use champagne yeast, you can use wild yeast. You can use wine yeast on top of the natural yeasts to kind of get a blend. There are a lot of options, and it's really easy. It's actually a really gratifying first brewing project because it's so simple and it's ready so much more quickly than a lot of other brews are. So if you like a sweet one, you can have yours ready to drink within a couple weeks. I like really tart, dry cider, so it takes a little bit longer, but there are just infinite ways of doing it.
So say, I know you've been fermenting. Actually, how long have you been fermenting things now?
Well, it kind of depends. I mean, home brewing, if you want to start with Beekvass, then that was like 10 years ago, but or yogurt would be like over 20 years ago. But if we're talking about like home brewing, then it would be the last 3 years. Yeah.
Okay. And say, you know, somebody wants to get involved with this or, you know, start their first fermentation project. I know when I started, I had the idea like, you know, you have to be very careful, you know, you don't want to get yourself sick. But then as you go through the literature and what people recommend, do you have any advice, you know, about say someone who's nervous, you know, the safety factor of it? I mean, can you make yourself sick? You know, what are some of the precautions?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I have never made myself or anyone else sick. I have really good hygiene, but I am not neurotic at all about that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, most people who've been fermenting for a long time are the same way. Everyone kind of starts to relax and realize, like, oh, you know, like good bacteria almost always beat out the bad bacteria. And there are just a few basic rules to follow, and then you're good. And actually, you know, if there is a problem, you can usually smell it or see it. So I think in that regard, I just want to encourage people, you know, to learn a few basics, but to not worry so much about it. And then maybe just take a class with someone, because I know that that can be really reassuring. Like, if you've never seen what it looks like to, you know, put a jar of sauerkraut together, it is really helpful to just go check it out. I think there are lots of classes popping up right now for fermentation, and there are a lot of online classes as well.
Yeah, it seems like a rejuvenation of, you know, fermenting things. It's finally kind of coming back into vogue again.
Yeah.
So what kind of foods have you fermented? I know you mentioned sauerkraut and a beet kvass.
So, you know, I remember drinking kombucha for the first time when I was like 18 and it totally blowing my mind. And so as soon as I could, I figured out how to make kombucha, and I grew up with us making our own yogurt, in my family. Kefir or kefir, however you want to say it. And then the water grains for that, sourdough bread, and then all kinds of vegetable ferments and fruit chutneys. I'm trying to think if there's anything missing that I haven't mentioned, like all kinds of, oh, and I also do, some cured meats as well. So I've also learned recently how to ferment meats, which is new for me. So, all kinds of things, I should say. Yeah,
I bet. You're probably a little braver than me with the meats. But, I mean, I guess then again, I'm also vegan. So
yeah, I don't blame you then.
Yeah, I was actually curious about that too. So what is your food philosophy? You know, I'm vegan. You might be something else like paleo, or just eat regular food or real food. What's your food philosophy, and how does that fit into fermentation?
I actually just did a video today talking some about that. But I was actually vegan for 5 years. And then I was really meticulous about it. Made everything from scratch and all that stuff. But for me, it didn't work well for my body. I ended up with some real deficiencies and things. So, it was a really gradual, shift all the way to the other side. Now I fall more into the paleo camp. And I'm my organic butcher is one of his best, customers. So, I think that really there's so much wisdom in the way that our ancestors used to eat. And I'm not talking about Neanderthal ancestors necessarily. I'm just talking about, you know, our grandparents and our great grandparents, you know, and the idea of really using as much of the food that's available as possible. A lot of the things that we used to throw away, or a lot of traditional food preservation methods, weren't just for preservation, but it actually increase the nutrition that was available through those foods. So we are huge food fans in my family, and I think it's hard. I've been in both sort of food communities, the vegan community and the paleo community. And something I see a lot is just a lot of rules and a lot of sort of dogma that comes forward. And I know it comes from a good place of people wanting to be healthy and wanting to make the right choices. But I also see a lot of people losing their joy when it comes to food, and losing a piece of community when it comes to eating together. And I think that's something that I've kind of been made aware of as a problem for me that I've been working hard with myself to not do. And so that's just kind of where I'm coming from with food, is that it's meant to be a source of community and joy. It's meant to be, eating is meant to be a relaxing activity. And so I don't want to do anything at the table that causes stress. But it's just kind of a really wonderful ritual to share with people you love every day.
Yeah, I know what you mean there about the dogmas and, you know, the different ways that people eat. And I think you can be healthy on so many different kinds of diets. And just like you, I think food is more, it's a cultural thing. It brings people together. And, you know, anybody that's trying to improve their health, and as long as you keep on learning. And I think pretty much if there was one rule that would be universal is just eat more natural, less processed foods. And, you know, no matter what it is, whether it's meat or vegan items. Have you actually noticed any health benefits from making fermented foods, or is it more of just like an enjoyment?
You know, I have to say that there wasn't a point in my life when I suddenly started incorporating lots of ferments. I think it was kind of gradual for me. So in that way, it would be kind of hard for me to pinpoint like a turning point in my life when fermented foods came in and made a difference. But I do know that when we don't eat a lot of fermented foods, both my husband and I just really start craving them. And we feel better when we have them.
What does your friends or family think about some of the things that you make? You know, or do they think you're kind of crazy for doing this, or you're a little strange, or you're like, you know, the cool person?
I'd like to think the latter, but it's kind of hard to know. I think most people are really, really nice and polite. And so most people haven't really said anything rude to me about it. Because of my blog, you know, I'm lucky because I get to attract people who are interested. You know what I mean? So it's not like I wouldn't have people reading my blog if they were really horrified by the idea of fermentation. So I naturally get to have this group of people to interact with that really want to learn more and are really interested and want to hear more. So that's really nice. And in my family, you know, there's 7 of us and all of us are kind of crunchy. My brothers, I have 5 brothers and I think 4 of them brew beer. And that's kind of one of my first exposures to home fermentation or home brewing was through them. They're all really interested in it. And if I have any questions, I can ask them. And my parents make fermented food. My sister makes all kinds of fermented food. So sometimes when I come across someone who's never had it, or who's horrified by the idea or something, it's a shock to me because I'm lucky enough to be in a sort of subculture where it's fairly normal. Other people who, you know, just met me or something, they seem really interested. I think they seem a little like, what? You can do that? But most of them seem really interested and want to taste everything that I've got bubbling in my demijohns and are really curious.
That's very cool. You know, going back just a little bit, I was thinking when you said you like to forage for wild edibles.
Yeah.
I can only imagine the different flavors that you can get. Because, you know, I go to my farmer's market and they just have, you know, sometimes they bring in interesting fruits or vegetables. But what's it like foraging for different foods? And does it make up a, you know, a good chunk of your diet?
Yes. Let's see. Does it make up a good chunk of our diet? In a way, it makes up a huge amount of our liquid diet. We really try to make lots of drinks as much as we can, especially this time of year, but then later on in the year. And then it kind of depends on the season, you know, because we do have more extreme seasons here in terms of when stuff is available and not available. So in the springtime, we ate a lot of foraged greens, and they were really different from what you'd pick up at the farmer's market. And then we just started, since we moved to England 3 years ago, we started eating stinging nettles. And that was unique and found a lot of different ways to use those. And we actually made a stinging nettles beer that was really good. It turned out like an IPA. And I have a recipe for that on my blog. And
I'll definitely be checking that out.
Okay, good. And there are just a lot of different fruits and things here that I had never tried. And the interesting thing is that that I find really interesting about England is that the sort of agricultural planning had foragers in mind somewhat. So in between all the farm fields are something called hedgerows. And it's just kind of like a natural wall made out of shrubs. And those shrubs are mainly edibles. So like hazelnuts, blackberries, hawthorn berries, sloes, which again are those tiny little really astringent plums, and all kinds of different edibles in these rows. And so they feed wildlife, which helps with preserving wildlife and natural land. And then it feeds people. And there's a culinary tradition here of foraging and making like hedgerow jelly. And the hedgerow jelly can be anything. I mean, it can be apples, blackberries, sloes, hawthorn berries, rose hips. So it's been really fun to kind of explore all of that while we've been here. And like right now I have rose hip syrup happening on the stove. And I'm trying to decide if I'm going to make a rose hip soda maybe with that, or make a rose hip, or just keep it as a syrup and use it to flavor drinks, or use it as some medicine. I haven't quite decided yet, but we gathered those this week and I'm just kind of processing them. And so, I mean, yes, to answer your question, like we get so many different interesting flavors and there are so many ways to use them and to try to explore. So that's been a really fun part of our experience here in England.
If only we had more of that over here.
I know.
I mean, some people are starting to revive it with more of the permaculture movement, mm-hmm. where, you know, you're interplanting berries and different wild edibles to attract the wildlife, yeah. and pollinators and things like that. Yeah, I can only imagine how different it is over in England. I know part of your story was you're an expatriate, mm-hmm. and you used to live in California.
Yeah, I'm from Los Angeles.
Has there been any kind of like a culture shock moving over to England, or?
Yes. I mean, there always is, you know, so I moved to the Philippines when I was 8 and then lived there for 10 years. And so my adult life was mostly in Los Angeles. And then before we moved to England, we were living in Germany for a little while. And it was really interesting because I think, like, whether you think about it or not, certain cultures just kind of jive more with who you are as a person than others do, regardless of your nationality and how you grew up. It's like a personality thing. So what surprised me is that I feel like Germany was a much better match for me. When we were there, it seemed like the culture was a lot easier to assimilate to and just felt a little more welcoming. And when we moved to England, after like having done the whole, you know, don't speak the language, moving over there kind of thing, to move to a country where we do speak a common language, like it felt a little bit like cheating. It felt so easy comparatively, but as time went by, also kind of realized like, oh my gosh, I have a lot more culture shock here than I ever experienced in Germany. And that mostly just comes from cultural differences in terms of how people operate socially. Everyone is just a lot more reserved. It's a very introverted culture. And even though I'm an introvert, I'm still really friendly and outgoing, and I still enjoy people. But it's just people really, you know, kind of keep to themselves. And there's some xenophobia there, at least in my area, my little town where I live. It's just harder to kind of break in. And we're moving to Spain in February, and I'm just really looking forward to like a kind of warmer, more party-oriented, friendlier sort of social environment. But I know that for a lot of people, this would be perfect. Like it would totally jive with so many people I know. So you never really know what to expect when you move to a new place.
Oh, I bet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Speaking of being an introvert,
yes.
How has that been? I mean, you know, you seem like you're very public and out there. You know, I can say the same thing for myself. I'm, you know, a little more introverted. It's kind of strange that I have a podcast now, you know, talking to people. But, uh-huh. you know, it seems very enjoyable. Yeah. And you're out there making videos, and you even have a cookbook. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about that, about how did you get that started and what's in the cookbook?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say that it's not a cookbook with fermented recipes. I actually am working on a new one that is going to be all fermentation, like drinks that you can make. And I'm really excited about that. This one was all about grain-free meals because we have some food allergies in my family. And I know so many families who are working around similar issues and looking for really good food that just doesn't include grains. So it is just full of really good meals from all over the world, different recipes, because I've lived in so many different places. that I thought it'd be great to just share so many different ways of cooking without using grains. And it's not really like, it's not all about being grain-free. It's just really good food that happens to be grain-free.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, I'm looking through here now. I see you have the different sections, breakfast, dinner, sides, sweets. Mm-hmm. But that carrot and parsnip cake looks kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super good. I'm actually craving it right now. We're waiting to get some almond flour in the mail.
Oh, almond flour.
Yeah.
Have you ever actually tried to make your own? So say you make almond milk mm-hmm. and then use the leftover pulp as like a almond flour.
You know, I have not done that, although I know quite a few people who do it. Yeah, I think it's a great idea. We just don't use a lot of milk. I don't know. We just don't have it like as a daily thing over here. I think if I was making the almond milk, I would definitely make my own almond flour with the pulp. It's a great idea.
I know it takes a little bit longer to make, you know, the almond because you have to soak them. And mm-hmm. if you actually want to try something really interesting in any of your recipes, mm-hmm. say you need something kind of fatty mm-hmm. and you're not using milk or like a heavy cream, try a half a cup of cashews with 2 cups of water. Cashews, yeah. They really, we make some really good French toast with that.
Yeah. You know, in my vegan days, I remember making some incredible things with cashews. Like you can make the most amazing ice cream and all kinds of things. It's really great. Super creamy.
Talking about a lot of the other things that you've fermented, is there anything in the future that, you know, you'd be really interested in getting into? I know you do homebrew, hard cider, you've mentioned sauerkraut and you've done sourdough breads. Is there anything else that you've thought about, you know, maybe trying, experimenting?
You know, with winter coming up, I know it might not be as interesting to you, but maybe some others. So I do plan on doing more cured meats because that is a really fascinating one for me. And that is one that's technically trickier. So it's more of a challenge. But I'm looking forward to trying some more cured meats this winter when it's cold enough that I can hang things in my conservatory. And I'm trying to think what else. You know, there are just a lot of more sort of lesser known ferments that aren't quite as mainstream that I'd like to try. You know, but some of them are things like you have to order special cultures for. So I'm totally interested. Yeah, just kind of whatever I can find to try. What am I missing? What haven't I done?
Oh, you know, speaking of things, you know, that you want to try, mm-hmm. I saw a little blurb in your blog there that you had tried durian, and I'm yeah. all for trying exotic fruits. Just recently, me and my wife went down near Miami, uh-huh. and they had an exotic fruit festival. Ooh. They had 300 different types of mango, which is,
wow.
you know, you had no idea. There's so many types, but we tried something called jackfruit,
yes.
which was the largest fruit in the world. Oh my God, the flavor was amazing.
I grew up on that, yeah.
Yeah, true. In the Philippines, you probably had it in your backyard, right?
Well, not quite in our backyard, but there were some places where we could find them. But we had a pet monkey, and our monkey always smelled like jackfruit because that was his favorite. But we really liked it too. It's so cool. I mean, it's like got the seed inside and then you have to sort of peel the pod away from the seed. And that's the part that you eat. And really cool.
What was durian like? I still have yet to find that. I've looked all over and I can't seem to find it anywhere around here.
Yeah. Durian is definitely an acquired taste. And when you do come across it, the smell will put you off. But I want to dare you to try it anyway because it smells terrible. It really does. I mean, people joke about it, tasting like heaven and smelling like the other place is what they would say. It has kind of a weird oniony smell, kind of like, I don't know, it's like onions and, or maybe more like roasted garlic, but kind of sweet. And so it's just really weird for a lot of people.
Did you just eat it or did you try it in something?
No, I just ate it. And like as a kid, I was always super open to like every flavor. There are very few foods that I didn't like and I always wanted to try everything. But for a lot of people, that's not the case. And what they would say to, you know, because of course, like everyone who visited or every new person who showed up in our community had to try durian. And what they would say is you have to try it 3 times because the first time you'll probably hate it. And then the second time you probably still won't like it, but it might not be quite as bad. And the third time, you'll probably be hooked. So I think that's a really good food philosophy in general, to just keep trying the things that you don't think you like. And you may find your new favorite food. So durian is a super, super weird fruit that just doesn't make any sense in your brain when you first try to eat it. But some people just totally love it.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I'll have to remember that.
Yeah.
Try a food three times.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm kind of that way about okra.
Ooh, is it a texture thing?
Yeah, I think so. The slime. I mean, I've pickled it, and, you know, mm-hmm. I have jars of it in the fridge right now, but for some reason, I keep on trying it, you know, just try to like it.
Yeah, it's hard. That's a tricky one. I can't say the okra was something I liked when I first tried it either. The texture.
Probably fried is like, you know, maybe more the way to go to soak up some of that slime.
Yeah, that's weird.
But as we get toward the end here, mm-hmm. say, would you have any tips or, you know, any kind of advice for somebody getting into fermentation?
Yeah, I would say, you know what, just go for it. Just try it. And I know it's really daunting for a lot of people. But just start with something really easy. Like I think sauerkraut, which I believe I heard you saying as a good intro, one of your other podcasts, I think that's perfect. Start with sauerkraut or start by, you know, getting a bottle of juice that does not have potassium sorbate in it. And just adding a little bit of whey from your yogurt and try fermenting that as a soft drink. I mean, there are so many really simple ways to get going. And the other thing is that you have an incredible resource of support online. I mean, the internet's kind of amazing. There's so many people who are so into fermenting, and like this podcast is a great example that there are so many people who are doing it and wanting to encourage other people to do it and helping. So you've got all the resources you need to just get started. Pick a project and do a little research, Google it, and just jump in. And then if you have any questions, you know, look for some blogs or this podcast, contact Paul and ask any questions you may have. But I think once you get started, you'll really love it and just want to keep doing it.
Oh, that sounds perfect. As we close out the show, Ariana, can you let the listeners know where they can find your site? You know, browse through some of your recipes that you have there, buy your cookbook or your, you know, Facebook or Pinterest or whatever else you'd like to share with them.
Sure. I would love for you to visit me at andherewear.net. And that's my website where I share a lot of recipes, a lot of kind of fun adventures from being expats here in England and life in the country here, as well as all sorts of cool fermentation projects. And you can find me on Pinterest too. All of my social media buttons are up in the right-hand corner, but I have some great foraging and fermentation boards that you could follow. And I'm on Facebook where I love sharing a bunch of cool projects. So I would love for you to say hello, let me know that you found me through this podcast, and love to have you following along.
All right. So everything we've talked about will be on today's show in the show notes. And I invite everyone to come out to fermentationpodcast.com, leave some comments, and also check out Ariana's site, And Here We Are, and maybe buy her cookbook. It looked really interesting. Ariana, I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to be here, and I'm so honored to be your first guest.
Ah, thank you very much. This has been Paul Bates from the Fermentation Podcast, along with Ariana Mullins, encouraging you to put fermentation into practice, ferment responsibly, and get out there and create some culture.